hello and a very warm welcome to our podcast, Successful Student Transitions, A Time to Thrive. It's hosted by Louise Wiles and me, Elizabeth Gillis. And in the podcast, we aim to be a companion for young people when they step out of school into further study or work and help them thrive in new environments. And of course, as young adults are moving on with their life, moving to university, expanding their horizons, these are changes, and there are changes also in family life. It's a transition in the life of the family. And time and effort is rightly focused on supporting young adults in this change. However, what about the parents? They're the ones that are staying put and experiencing perhaps the empty nest. And today I'm delighted to welcome Professor Paul Grantham. He's a consultant clinical psychologist. He's a founder and director of SDS Seminars, which is a home for a wide range of psychotherapy training in the UK. And I was really fortunate enough to join a series of workshops that Paul recently held on empty nest. And his thinking and approach to this life transition is so interesting and helpful. So welcome, Paul.
Hi, it's good to be with you today, Elizabeth.
Yeah, great. Now, I'd like you to start off, if you can, Paul, and just saying why you're interested in this area of empty nest.
Yes. I mean, it's an interesting question, really, because as a clinical psychologist, I can't say that I originally had that many clients that were presenting with this as a problem. Where I actually first came across it was actually in the work that I was doing in terms of supervising other clinical psychologists and counselors. And it was coming up in the cases that they wanted to explore and look at. And I was initially quite sort of taken by this because I had not come across it before. I'd heard of the term, but I hadn't come across it before. I'd certainly received no training in it. And I probably, if I'm honest, I'll come back to this point later on, but I carried around some of the prejudices that are actually around regarding empty nest syndrome, which I probably wasn't even aware of at the time. So I just thought to myself, my goodness, there are so many practitioners I'm working with here who are coming across this or dealing with it that I really ought to start looking into in more detail. And I'll say a little bit more about that, but I was first very struck by the real absence of research literature in the field. I'll come back to that point later on. But what I did do was I decided to start directly asking my own clients about it and about certain elements of it. And it's at that particular point that I really discovered it played quite a central role, in fact, for a number of people, despite the fact that they might not necessarily raise it as a primary issue in therapy. So that's really where my interest came from.
So do you think it's a bit of a hidden issue then, Paul?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think it's a hidden issue. I think that there's quite a lot of prejudice about it. I think there is an assumption that floats around that either this was a historical concern, happily come back to that later on if you want to, it was a historical concern which is no longer around, or a subtler version of this was that if people did have this as a problem, they shouldn't have it. I don't really want to go so far as to say people blame people who are suffering from empty nest syndrome that it's their fault, but there is a slight feeling, I think, around in some of the sort of media articles that are written about this in particular, which suggests that those sorts of beliefs might be around. Yeah.
And I'm sure we'll talk about it because it is quite a complex, as you were in your research, it's a complicated area, isn't it? Yeah. Do you want to kind of start with saying about where, you know, I know you did a lot of research around emptiness, about where the origins of these words come from, and maybe the kind of relevance of the emptiness in today's world.
Sure. Yeah. So as a concept, it was first created by Dorothy Canfield Fisher, who was basically a social researcher during the first half of the 20th century. And she coined the term in a book that she wrote called Mothers and Children. I should say that it's worth bearing in mind that when she originally coined the term, she didn't necessarily see it as a problematic issue. She used it in a much more descriptive way, but she was quite struck at the time by how American society was changing, that there were certain changes which had led to the concept of an empty nest. And an empty nest here basically means that parents are left by themselves within the family home without any other extended family around them, and also obviously with children having left home. And the children leaving home at that stage largely was a reflection of increasing urbanization in late 19th century, early 20th century America, so that rather than children, in a sense, staying on the farm or staying around and obviously living with their parents, you might, for example, have more than one generation living in the same home. What was now happening was that children were leaving, they were moving to the cities. And in addition to that, the key role of the extended family, whether we're talking about siblings, whether we're talking about aunts, uncles, or they're talking particularly about grandparents, basically was less central to family life as a result of that, because basically the nuclear family was in many ways dissolving at a certain point. It, as a concept, however, it sort of really became popular in the 1970s and 1980s. And probably at that particular point in time, there was an assumption that there was what was called a linear launch occurring for parents in their 40s. So this would typically be, by that stage, a lot of children leaving home to go to university, or maybe in some instances they wouldn't go to university, but they would be moving away from the geographical area where they'd grown up. By the time we get to this particular point in the 21st century, we've had some changes that have occurred. So, for example, we now know that empty nest still occurs, but first of all, it's more delayed. So it's more likely to affect parents in their late 40s and 50s. And also it's non-linear in that respect, in the sense that, you know, sometimes children will come back home after a period of time when they're at university, or in some instances they might be living with a partner and that relationship breaks up and a child returns to the home before they then go off again. So that's the sort of brief history of how it's actually occurred.
So that kind of those boomerang children that we called on, they're coming and going. So it's less kind of discrete, isn't it? It's more like
very much
flux, isn't it? So
yeah, it is.
That can be part of the issue as well, can't it? Yeah,
it can. It can be an issue in a number of ways. I mean, I guess the most obvious point to actually make here is that it makes adjustment to a life change more difficult. So certainly, I think for some parents, they have, after a period of time, adjusted to their children not being there, and then their children come back for a period of time into the family home, which requires an adjustment again. It requires an adjustment for the parents, but it also, of course, requires an adjustment for the children. Yeah. So the children may have been living quite independent lives, not having to check in, for example, with parents. Parents are used to their children checking in on them. I'm talking about things like just asking what time you're going to be home of a night. Yeah. And that's potentially a cause of conflict, as well, obviously, as certain benefits for some folks as well.
So for parents, and I'm thinking, you know, particularly for parents where their kids are going off to university or they're going off to work somewhere else, you know, who talks to parents about the empty nest at the moment? I don't think they do, Paul, do they? I don't think it's out there.
They don't. Yet they don't. Although, interestingly enough, there's a couple of recent surveys on this that have actually been conducted specifically in terms of asking parents in connection with their children leaving for university. And there, the figures that are coming through in the surveys are very high indeed, in the 90%. And that, in addition to that, it's probably worth also mentioning that the data that's around indicating the experience of this for fathers is even slightly higher than it is for mothers. So it's undoubtedly around. What is very interesting about it is that it's not being talked about. And that, I think, is a key issue and a key problem, really.
And I think when I was doing the course with you, and I think one of the statistics you quoted was that 98% of parents felt extreme grief.
Yes, undoubtedly.
When their children left for university.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's happening to the other 2%. But I mean, that's a big figure, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a phenomenal figure. I do want to say that for some people, this is simply a temporary adjustment period, and they do adjust, as you know, we do to varying degrees, adjust to other major life changes. But that's not guaranteed at all. For some people, it is unfortunately the start of a major issue for them, which is ongoing.
Yeah. And I think in parallel to this, while I'm really interested in it too, one, because I kind of went through the emptiness myself, but two, in that the work that Louise and I, who run the podcast, what we've both experienced is having long spells of living abroad. And so we were primed for that. We were told when this change happens to you, you're going from being a place where you know everything and you know people, and then you're suddenly in this other world, a different culture. And it's not like the way. So this is an adjustment thing. You'll need to do these things, and this will happen, and that will happen, and you'll have a dip and everything. And so when we work with young people going to university, it's a similar thing. We say, this is what change is like. And then then help them think about what they're like and change. And this is the same for parents, isn't it, too? That I think you're right to say this is a normal experience.
Yeah, but it's one that requires adjusting too. I don't think it's the only issue, but I think one of the issues is that, you know, if you're looking at this particularly within the context of children leaving to go to university, that is seen as an achievement to be celebrated, understandably. And when you are looking at something which is primarily framed as an achievement, in a peculiar way, you don't have permission in the same way to say this is a loss or this is a painful or difficult adjustment. You're supposed to be overwhelmingly happy.
You're supposed to be happy at this. And I think a similar thing happens when kids go off to university. They're told this is the best years of your life.
Right.
Well, it's not. Right. They don't have the permission to say, I'm struggling, I'm finding this difficult. Right. So there's a parallel process in there as well, isn't there?
There is, isn't there? Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
What are some of the kind of myths around this kind of emptiness? You've mentioned a few things, but what do you think is...
Right. Well, I think that the most central one that's actually around is that first of all, that this is no longer an issue. And it's been framed as, in inverted commas, no longer an issue because it has been believed that emptiness syndrome really only applies to non-working women.
Yeah.
In other words, women whose identity is around in the home, and that with the increasing number of women in the workforce, this is no longer an issue because a woman's identity is no longer solely defined by what they're doing in the home. And there's a whole range of reasons why that is just a myth, partly because just factually it's not true. Mm. And secondly, we've got some really interesting data from other countries where the percentage of the female workforce is very, very similar to, for example, the percentage in the female workforce of females in the workforce in the UK, and yet this is still recognised as being a big issue that needs to be addressed. So I think that's sort of one thing. The second thing is, which is the sort of a sort of subtler version of it, is that if women do have this problem, then they shouldn't have. And that the sort of solution to it is stop, you know, being so child, stop being so home defined, and basically, I'm putting this very crudely, go out and find yourself a new role where you can define yourself within work, and that women who have already done this don't have this problem. This is a big myth, but it's incredibly predominant myth as well. I think it's a myth, as we've already alluded to, that this is an exclusively female issue. It's clearly not. The data says otherwise. So there's a whole range of things where there are assumptions floating around, very embedded assumptions, can I say, which are basically not true. And you know, one thing that was a massive discovery for me when I was first researching into the area was, and I still have difficulties believing that this is true as I say it to you, but it is, I could not find a single peer-reviewed article in the field of empty nest syndrome which has been published in a US or UK academic journal since 2015.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's a period of 10 years and nobody, certainly, I mean, I'm talking here primarily psychologists, nobody has published or done any research on it. It's almost like it's being treated as a total non-issue, which is utterly, well, both bizarre and very concerning, to be honest.
And I've also heard you talk about, Paul, that it's also, as psychologists or researchers, people are interested in early years, you know, young adults, and then what happens to adult development. People aren't that interested in it. Yeah,
very much so. I mean, I've sort of known in the back of my head, I guess, and I've known through my own practice, that there is, generally speaking, a prejudice in the psychotherapy field, basically as people get older. And if we just focus in on women as one example of this, there is no real interest I've ever seen in psychological literature regarding women, probably beyond menopause. Menopause is the last issue that's actually around that's looked at. And beyond that, there is no interest. There's no interest. And that's generally speaking the case for older people. And there's also a general assumption as well that if we're talking about development in the sense of age-related development that occurs, you will, of course, find a great deal that's written in connection with children and adolescents. But broadly speaking, once people hit early adulthood, which is broadly seen around about the age of 25, There's this general assumption that development doesn't occur any further,
yeah,
unless it's going to maybe relate to bereavement, possibly retirement at a yeah, much later point in time. So yeah, I think there's this unfortunate prejudice and assumption that developmental life changes are not really something that most adults have to negotiate. And certainly this is one that's most commonly ignored, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, I like the writing of Bruce Feiler, Life and Condition. You know, and he talks about, you know, us as adults having big transitional points every 12 to 18 months. And he calls them life quakes, these really
right,
big ones. You know,
right,
you've got to think, well, if this is a truth, you know, people have looked and researched this, then why aren't we helping people to manage these big ones, you know, and change? So, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that's very true. And I think what's interesting about it is that I often find that those smaller but more frequent life changes are something which one might talk about within family or maybe friends, but are just not recognized as something that people need help with.
Yeah.
They're not recognized in that particular way at all.
So then there is that myth then that, you know, change is a positive thing, that all change is good, and that we should just roll with it. So there's another myth as well, isn't it?
Yeah, very
much so. It's interesting that there's no research about it. So maybe there's a big opening there. So I
really hope that this situation is going to change, really. And it's one of the reasons why I want to basically shine a light on this particular issue, because it does need to be illuminated much more. It is very striking, as I say, that it has been ignored particularly. Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. I have kind of access to kind of reading things that parents are writing about their kids going off to university, and whether it's a short-term issue or going into a longer-term one, at that short-term bit, it's a really big issue for them.
Oh, undoubtedly. And, you know, we've got a lot of data on that. And can I just say, whether it's seen as short term or long term, even if it's short term, some of the issues that are actually around for parents do require addressing, can I say, rather than automatically assuming that they will resolve. If you look at the census-wide survey that was published in 2021, for instance, a fairly large survey of 1,000 UK parents whose children have gone to university, nearly a third of those that were surveyed actually described themselves as drinking more alcohol, for instance, since their children had left. Now, that may or may not be a short-term issue, but it's certainly not something I think we can ignore very easily. And also changes, of course, potentially to the wider family, both in terms of younger siblings or changes that have occurred in terms of the primary relationship with their partner.
Yeah. Can we just talk on a little bit more about that? Because I think it's really important, even if some parents are listening in, to think about, well, what are the kind of common things that happen, you know, around this transition, you know, maybe if we say especially to go to university, there are some common issues for parents, aren't there?
There are. So we'll start off, obviously, with the one that you just mentioned, which is more than just sad, but, you know, as you quite rightly highlighted in that survey, extreme grief at children leaving for university. There's an issue which we may or may not have time to go back to later on, but one thing that is commonly reported is that it raises question marks for a number of reasons in many people's primary relationship with their partner. So it's estimated that in fact, in that particular survey, it was indicated that about one in six parents, quote unquote, question the stability of their marriage or partnership. Around about a third found that their dynamic with their other children changed and that they became more clingy. There's a real rippling out effect here, not just in the primary relationship between the child or children who've left home and the parents, but within, for want of a better term, the individuals remaining in the nest, and what actually happens for them.
And then there's an identity issue as well, isn't there?
Yes, there is an identity issue, and it is a big concern, I think, for a lot of people. Who am I, basically? I think there's a number of things I want to say about this because it's sort of an issue that interfaces with some of the myths that I mentioned earlier on. I think the first thing to say is whether or not parents are working, at the end of the day, a lot of their energy, a lot of their identity, a lot of their time has been taken up with their children. Mm-hmm. And that is now changing. It's quite interesting. I think a lot of parents actually often describe themselves as no longer having their children or losing their children in some particular way. The reality, of course, is that they are still parents and they still have their children, but undoubtedly the nature of the relationship's changed. Yeah. So that raises all sorts of questions, from what do I do with my time? How am I supposed to relate to my children now? How do I see myself? There's a lot of people, not surprisingly, who have got a lot of their meaning in life and a lot of a meaning in their identity from their relationship with their children. And suddenly they are confronted with the question of, well, if this is no longer such a central element in terms of how I see myself, what should it be? Some people may wish to reinvest more time, more energy into their work career if they have that, and that's fine. But there's a lot of people that don't want to do that. Indeed, we know that some people, for instance, at this particular point in time, will actually take it as a punctuation point in which to leave the work, which has actually not had necessarily a great deal of meaning for them for a period of time, and think about where to refocus their time and where to refocus their energies. But to be honest with you, are often not very clear about it. then there's a whole thing. I mean, this is such a big area, but there's two areas I think that everyone needs to consider about how, as human beings, we answer that question of who am I and what is my purpose. One is from a set of beliefs that come from our earlier experience, from childhood and also afterwards, and from the key messages that we received from message givers in our own family when we were growing up and in our early adulthood. And that's we carry those with us throughout our lives to varying degrees. But then there's also another thing which I don't think can be ignored, which is that in many ways our identity is determined by our activities. So what it is that we spend our time doing or have been doing automatically shapes who it is we see ourselves as being. And those two elements need reflection, and I think people often need help with them as well in terms of them being renegotiated.
Yeah. And that kind of changed because I guess for all of us as parents, we're not the same parent as we were when we had babies, you know?
Quite.
We've changed. So that's, we need to kind of hold on to that idea that we can change and we can adapt to situations. And this is one that we might need some more thinking about because we don't have that need definitely to do something right now because the young adult is far away from us. So, yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I often do with parents is something along those sorts of lines that you're talking about, in the sense that, you know, that idea of, you know, what do I do now? Who am I? Is based on an assumption that everything previously was fixed and now it's no longer fixed.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, I will often have discussions with parents about how their role as a parent has changed already over the lifetime of their relationship with their child. And as you rightly point out, you know, what it means to be a parent with a six-month-old baby is different from a six-year-old, which is different from a 10-year-old, which is different from a 16-year-old, and so on and so forth. In other words, that ability to adapt and change is something which is already there, which the individual already has the ability to do. But maybe we just need to rediscover that in order to give us the confidence to change further at this point in time.
Yeah, because you're right. I mean, I come across parents who will say to me as well, oh, they've gone. Like, this is the end, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, it's the end of that.
Yeah.
And it's a beginning of something else, isn't it?
Quite. And there will be further changes in the future as well, of course.
Yeah.
So, you know, there will be an adaptation at this point in time, which is maybe more focused on the fact that my child is living a more independent life, more away from me. But of course, if grandchildren come into the picture at some point in time, there's likely to be yet another change that's going to be occurring in the relationship.
And I think that kind of period of time, and I've seen it through other friends' children when they're young adults before they have their own children, it's often a time that they don't really want their parents that much until then, the, you know, so it's that I've been there, they're not there. And I think it comes back again I've seen it come back again when there's grandchildren around.
And that, by the way, can be a whole new negotiation issue. Because it's not necessarily the case that grandparents and parents have a meeting of minds automatically on what roles should be.
Yeah. I mean, it is a huge topic, this, isn't it, Paul? And I think I'm very grateful that you've kind of raised the complexity of it and then are talking about it. And I hope there's some research about it as well. I don't know if you could just maybe finish off by maybe giving parents who are going through that empty nest thing, maybe even some things you've already said about giving them some wisdom or hope at this kind of stage that they might be in.
Sure. Well, the first thing I would say is, particularly if you are experiencing this shortly after the leaving of the child from home, for a lot of people, this is a temporary adjustment.
Yeah.
It is something which for some people will naturally resolve itself. I wouldn't automatically assume that you have to jump in and get some specialist help, although obviously support at this point in time is helpful.
Yeah.
I think the second thing I would say is that if this is an ongoing issue for you, you might want to reflect on what are the most pressing issues for you. Are they about loss and loneliness? Are they about the sort of psychological issues that are around of coping with this? If you are, for example, worrying a great deal about things all the time, if you're ruminating about them, is it an issue that relates to the relationship you have with your primary partner? Is that changing for good or for bad as a result of this, but which is something that you need to think through and focus on? And finally, is it an issue that relates to the whole question of who am I now and what should I be doing and what's my purpose? So that would be the second thing, which is that, you know, there are different things that can crop up for people on that. I would always, top of the list, suggest making sure that you have people around you that you can talk to about this. I think finding out that you're not the only one, getting help and support from them is a big plus. There are a whole range, obviously, of specialists and also psychological interventions that can be helpful when the problems are more serious. And I would always encourage people, if they find that they are not resolving things for themselves or through the natural support that they have from friends and family, to always seek out more specialist help.
Thank you for that. I love those three points. And we're going to include those in the summary. We often write a summary in the transcript. Paul, thank you very much for your time today. I know you're a very busy person. Thank you for your wisdom today. And thank you especially for those three points and in raising the importance of supporting parents at this stage of their lives. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Elizabeth.
Well, that was a really interesting conversation. So thank you so much to Elizabeth and our guest, Professor Paul Grantham. You know, it's so interesting to hear that an area so common to so many is so under-researched. But it's also encouraging to hear that while it can be a challenging time for many parents, it is one that they often resolve with time. Now, Paul ended the conversation with three key insights for parents that Elizabeth said we would summarise at the end. And so I wanted to summarise those here for you now. So firstly, remember this is often, as I have just said, a stage that will resolve itself with time. Secondly, if it does seem to become an ongoing issue for you, it's really helpful to reflect on what the most pressing issue for you is. Is it loss and loneliness? Is it psychological issues of coping with change, characterized perhaps by excessive worry and rumination? Or does it relate to the primary relationship with a partner? And thirdly, this stage can lead to questions about a sense of identity. Parents are no longer those full-time parents, and so perhaps are left asking, who am I? And what should I be doing now? What's my purpose now? Paul reminds us to find support from friends and family as we seek to work our ways through this period of change and adjustment, and reminds us that if issues continue, it may help to seek additional professional support. So we hope you have enjoyed this episode. You can learn more about Professor Paul Grantham by going to his website, sds-seminars.online. And to learn more about the work Elizabeth and I are doing, go to successfulstudenttransitions.com to view more about the podcast, learn about some upcoming webinars and courses. Thank you for listening. We'll be back soon with the next podcast episode. Bye-bye for now. And now for the legal bits. The information contained in this podcast is for information purposes only. The content is not intended to act as a substitute for professional advice. Please do not delay in seeking professional help for any medical or mental health condition. Use of the information on this podcast and associated materials is at the user's own risk.